Today is Tuesday, May 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. With the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan just days away, the Taliban announces a ceasefire.
This is the third ceasefire the Taliban has announced since 2018 and during the same Eid holidays.
Plus, more violence in Israel after clashes at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, as well as an exchange of missile fire. We'll have these stories and more next. In Afghanistan, the Taliban has announced a nationwide ceasefire that will take effect when the three-day annual Muslim festival of Eid al-Fitr begins Thursday, marking an end to the Islamic fasting month of Ramadan. Ayaz Gul tells me it's welcome news, as fears of escalating violence persist as the United States and international forces continue their withdrawal after nearly 20 years of conflict. He began our conversation by explaining why the Taliban made this announcement.
Well, the Taliban leadership has instructed all their fighters across the country not to launch any offensive action against Afghan security forces, saying that that would create the sort of a safe and secure environment for Afghans to prepare for this Eid celebration, which is due to begin on Thursday. And you know, that was sort of a surprising announcement, because the kind of violence that has been taking place over the last few weeks, it has killed so many people that there were worries that this Afghan violence that was largely being anticipated to go out of control. But this ceasefire has come a big relief for Afghans. But just let me tell you that this is the third ceasefire the Taliban has announced since 2018 and during the same Eid holidays. And the good news was today that Afghan President Ashraf Ghani responded and ordering his national security forces to also cease, halt any offensive operations.
Ayaz, what about after Eid? Because the holiday only lasts a few days.
Well, what we have seen in the past that while the government of President Ghani has been willing to extend the ceasefire, it is the Taliban side that has never agreed and ignored international calls for extending this ceasefire beyond the three-day Eid festivities. And the Taliban are using these ceasefires, annual ceasefires, basically to increase their political influence, to convince Afghans that they are the people, they are the group which can provide them security. And by this announcement, you know, Taliban has been demonstrating to the players outside Afghanistan, the United States, that it has total control over its fighters, you know, against these suspicions that maybe the Taliban is, loose alliance of different groups, and which are acting independently. But over the last two ceasefires that we have witnessed, that once the Taliban instructed their fighters not to launch any offensive, the United Nations has been a witness and has established that over those two Eid ceasefires, not a single incident of violence happened from the Taliban side.
Ayaz, there has been concern that as U.S. and international forces withdraw, violence could continue to escalate following the Eid ceasefire. So what can you tell us about how the region is preparing for that?
It was interesting today in Afghanistan that the military chief of Pakistan, General Qamar Javed Bajwa, made an unannounced visit to Kabul, where he met Ashraf Ghani, and the British army chief was also present in that meeting, which shows that local regional actors are really worried about this intensified violence in Afghanistan, and they want to make sure that some kind of a peace deal between the Taliban and the Afghan government is struck so that this violence can be contained. And with, as I mentioned, that Pakistan's military chief being in Kabul today is very significant and shows that Pakistan remains under pressure from the United States, from other Western countries, to use whatever leverage it still has with the Taliban to convince them to re-engage in the peace process with the Afghan government and strike some kind of a peace deal. So there are worries, but let me tell you that what happened in the 1990s when the Soviet troops withdrew from Afghanistan and there was a civil war that followed that withdrawal, the same concerns are still prevailing here in Afghanistan with the withdrawal of the U.S. forces. But this time, the regional countries are worried that if this violence continues, terrorist groups like Islamic State will benefit from the instability in Afghanistan, which will threaten the regional security.
Ayaz Gul spoke to me from Islamabad. Violent clashes over Jerusalem escalated Monday, with Gaza health officials saying at least 20 people, including 9 children, were killed by Israeli airstrikes launched after Palestinian militant groups fired rockets close to Jerusalem. The rocket fire and Israeli airstrikes continued late into the night, with Palestinians reporting loud explosions close to Gaza City and across the coastal strip. Shortly before midnight local time, Israel's military said Palestinian militants had fired around 150 rockets into Israel, of which dozens were intercepted by its missile defense systems. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the rocket attacks from Gaza against Israel should stop immediately and urged all sides to take steps to reduce tensions. Earlier, I spoke with reporter Orly Halpern in Jerusalem about what led to the rocket attacks.
So Hamas had given an ultimatum to Israel to pull out its forces from the Temple Mount and from the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, where there were clashes going on. Already 300 people, Palestinians, had been injured. And it said to Israel, you pull out your people, your forces, by 6 p.m. And at 6:02, I think it was, suddenly you heard the war sirens that are all over this country going off. And people took cover. People all over the city took cover. And there were about 7 rockets that were identified that they all fell south of Jerusalem. Most of them were intercepted. Israel responded quite forcefully and shot missiles, some of them from drones. And in the meantime, 9 Palestinians have been killed. 3 of them are children. And Hamas continued and shot rockets into southern Israel, in the areas, cities around the Gaza Strip and the small communities around the Gaza Strip. So this is now going back and forth. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Hamas crossed a red line by shooting towards Jerusalem.
The rocket barrages come on yet another day of clashes in Jerusalem near and around the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Now, Monday was Jerusalem Day, a day that some Israelis celebrate as the retaking of the old west portion of the city from Muslim control. And there was already a concern of escalated violence that day.
Yes, the situation has become more and more volatile every day over the issue of this neighborhood, this Palestinian neighborhood where Israel plans to evict the Palestinians living there. And so people who are going up to the Temple Mount to pray were also demonstrating there and protesting for the sake of these Palestinians living in Sheikh Jarrah. The idea of celebrating conquering the Temple Mount, to go up to Temple Mount to celebrate that during the holy month of Ramadan, was seen as very problematic. And there were Palestinians that were waiting on the Temple Mount, there were some that were waiting with rocks to throw at any Jewish people that were going to come up and celebrate. The police, the Israeli police, stopped the Jews from coming up, but Palestinians threw stones at the police. And that's when it started, which ended with some 300 people, Palestinians injured, and 21 policemen injured.
Reporter Orly Halpern. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The United States is expanding the use of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to children as young as the age of 12. The Food and Drug Administration announced on Monday that the shot is safe and offers strong protection for younger teens based on the testing of more than 2,000 U.S. volunteers. Most vaccines rolling out worldwide have been authorized for adults. Indian coronavirus infections and deaths held close to record daily highs on Monday, increasing calls for the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi to lock down the world's second most populous country. Reuters' Saroya Ali is up next.
Police in Bangalore patrolled the streets on Monday, stopping vehicles, checking IDs, and even herding and whacking lockdown violators. Many states across India have imposed their own lockdown rules to curb the spread of the coronavirus. Prime Minister Narendra Modi is yet to announce a nationwide lockdown, despite mounting calls for one. India reported 3,754 deaths on Monday. That's down slightly from peak numbers reported the day before, though some experts say actual figures could be far higher. On Monday, U.S. company Eli Lilly & Co. said it signed licensing deals with Indian drug makers to make and sell its arthritis drug, baricitinib, for the treatment of COVID patients. Meanwhile, medical relief continued to pour in from other countries around the world. Crowds of people queued to get vaccines at a center in Punjab, but calls for social distancing went out the window. Dr. Jasmine is the center manager.
We have called the police to maintain social distance, but people are not listening to us. And we are saying continuously from the morning, please social distancing maintain.
India is the world's largest vaccine-producing nation, with the Serum Institute of India having mass-produced the AstraZeneca vaccine. But as of Sunday, the country had fully vaccinated just 2.5% of its population, over 34.3 million people, according to government data. Delhi's health minister said his city was running out of vaccines, the NDTV news channel reported, saying they have just 3 to 4 days of supplies of AstraZeneca's vaccine remaining.
Saroya Ali reports for Reuters News. Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga said on Monday that he has never put the Olympics first. As an opinion poll showed, nearly 60% of the people in Japan want the games canceled, with fewer than 11 weeks left before they're due to open. Japan has extended a state of emergency in Tokyo and three other areas until the end of May, and it's struggling to contain a surge of COVID-19 cases. That's raising more questions about whether the games should even go ahead. Japan's vaccination rate is also the lowest among wealthy nations. International Olympic officials, Tokyo planners, and Prime Minister Suga have insisted that the games will go on in a safe and secure way. However, foreign spectators will not be allowed, and planners issued an elaborate set of rules last month aimed at preventing coronavirus infections. But such arrangements have not eased public worries over the games that were postponed last year due to the coronavirus. Elsewhere, scientists in South Africa say COVID-19 variants first detected in the United Kingdom and India are now circulating in the country and are likely to increase the severity of a third wave of the pandemic. South Africa has been the hardest hit on the continent by COVID-19, with 1.6 million confirmed cases and almost 55,000 deaths. Now, as winter sets in, infections are once again surging. Darren Taylor takes it from here.
Medical scientists say the variants first found in the UK and India are unlikely to replace the one detected in South Africa late last year as the dominant strains. But they're still concerned, particularly about the three variants driving infections in India. Progressive Health Forum leader Dr. Aslam Dasu explains that scientists are trying to determine if these mutations increase transmission and virulence.
The upsurge in India indicates that is indeed the case. You would not be able to find that kind of transmission with the original founder virus, shall we put it that way. And with the force of infection, certainly of the kind we're seeing, tragically seeing in India, the emergence of more variants is inevitable.
Preliminary investigations by local scientists indicate that the imported variants, simply put, aren't as bad as South Africa's because they aren't as good at evading the immunity afforded by current vaccines. Nevertheless, say the medical minds, the fact that the mutations from the UK and India are now here can only add to the country's COVID-19 burden. South Africa's immunization drive is yet to begin in earnest, so Dasu urges citizens to maintain protective measures such as social distancing and wearing masks.
Look, we're not going to avoid a third wave. What we can do is determine the scale of that wave through the non-pharmaceutical interventions that we're all very familiar with. There's really nothing else that we have in our armory to protect people. We do know that you can reduce the peak of a wave and the extent of a wave just by utilizing those methods. But the third wave is upon us.
The problem is, according to Health Minister Zweli Mkhize, many South Africans have become complacent. This is putting pressure on the government to once again enforce a strict lockdown and to, for example, ban social gatherings. This wouldn't be necessary, says Dasu, if the state had a better vaccination strategy.
In short, it's woefully inadequate.
The government was forced to delay its immunization program a few months ago. This after it was determined that the AstraZeneca shot, of which it had bought 1 million, wasn't very effective in preventing mild to moderate COVID-19 in people with a variant dominant in South Africa. But, says Dasu, this excuse has only limited validity.
After that, it was clear, because it was very effective against severe illness, hospitalization and death, it should have been administered to as many South Africans as possible. Instead, we sold it off.
Like other countries, South Africa also had to pause its rollout of the Johnson & Johnson jab because of concerns it caused blood clots.
It was an unfortunate decision again. We lost a couple of weeks. That has now resumed. But our total vaccination is under 350,000. And this is of great concern, especially if we are trying to reach millions. We don't have the supply. And security of supply is a huge problem in any vaccination program, given the conditions of this particular virus. So we're in a very difficult situation going into the third wave. It would have been ideal in the past.
Dasu describes U.S. President Joe Biden's recent support of waiving intellectual property rights for COVID-19 vaccines as huge. The doctor believes it could result in a flow of vaccines to less affluent countries that need it most, such as South Africa, and potentially save hundreds of thousands of lives, if not more. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights is calling on Uganda to amend a bill to ban same-sex relations that it says would violate human rights standards and undermine public health. Lisa Schlein has those details.
The bill passed by the Ugandan parliament this past week, but not yet final, has been under development since 2015 and gone through several significant changes. Human rights officials say they are deeply troubled by the latest iteration, which would criminalize entire groups of people. Under the bill, they note consensual same-sex relations would be harshly punished, as would sex workers and those infected with HIV. Spokesman for the UN High Commissioner, Rupert Colville, notes the bill's punishment for consensual same-sex relations has been reduced to 10 years in jail instead of life imprisonment. Nevertheless, he says the Sexual Offenses Act raises serious human rights concern.
The fact remains that such relations are still criminalized. This in a country where stigma, discrimination, and violence against people based on their sexual orientation and gender identity is widespread and often committed with impunity, and given that victims are frequently too afraid to report any attack against them.
Colville says other alarming provisions in the Act include mandatory enforced HIV testing of defendants.
Such provisions not only violate Uganda's human rights obligations, but also risk undermining public health, leaving people afraid to come forward for essential testing and treatment, and so affecting critical HIV prevention and treatment efforts. It's also risking further fueling be fueling HIV in Uganda and in sub-Saharan Africa.
UNAIDS, the joint UN program on HIV/AIDS, says it fears driving people infected with HIV underground will undo much of the progress Uganda has made in reducing the impact of the disease. Since 2010, it says AIDS-related deaths have fallen by 60%. And new HIV infections have dropped by 43%. Colville says the bill provides much-needed protection on sexual violence, which is something women's groups and gender-based violence groups have advocated for some time. However, the bill in general, he says, does not comply with international law and standards and must be amended. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Britain and Europe on Saturday, May 9th, marked VE Day, the end of World War II in Europe. And advocates are raising the issue that the sacrifices of Black and South Asian soldiers who fought for the Allies are often ignored in those commemorations. But as Martha Vanderwolf reports, efforts are underway to change that.
More than 2 million African and Caribbean soldiers fought in the First and Second World Wars, and more than 2.5 million soldiers of the British Indian Army during the Second World War played an important role in the fight against Japan. But as advocates say, their stories are often left out of commemorations like VE Day. Selena Carty is a cultural and ancestral historian who has been advocating for years to include the contribution of all soldiers. She says the current national memory of the world wars are misrepresenting history.
Because every year when remembrance was done in this country for many years, there would be sparse Black faces. The majority is a white face, the same as you would go to France or Germany or any other European country. The education to be able to support this narrative in regards to why we're celebrating has been neglected. The films that continuously are made control and show a white narrative.
During the two world wars, Britain still had a vast global empire with colonies across the world. The soldiers from these colonies were fighting on behalf of the empire, and not always by choice. And they were not always treated equally. Documents in British National Archives show Black African soldiers were paid 3 times less than white British soldiers. London School of Economics professor Tarak Barkawi wrote a book about the multicultural armies of British Asia. He says the complicated role of British Empire soldiers in part explains why they were written out of history.
So one of the problems with colonial armies and commemoration is that neither the independent new state, you know, the decolonized state, is not interested in celebrating soldiers who fought to keep the country colonized and fought for the empire. And neither is the metropolitan power interested in remembering its dependence on Black and brown soldiers.
Last month, a report by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission concluded that pervasive racism was a reason why Black and Asian soldiers were not commemorated respectfully or at all after World War I. British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace recently apologized in Parliament on behalf of the government.
The report concludes that post-World War I, in parts of Africa, the Middle East and India, the Commission often compromised its principles and failed to commemorate the war dead equally. There can be no doubt prejudice played a part in some of the Commission's decisions.
The report estimates that between 45,000 and 54,000 combatants of Indian and African backgrounds did not receive equal recognition, and that up to 350,000 deaths among them were not commemorated by name or not at all. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, London.
Now, Sunday, May 10th was Mother's Day in the United States, and nothing could be more maternal for most babies under 6 months old than breast milk. However, today, manufacturers of breast milk substitutes have convinced many mothers to feed their babies with their products instead. Breast milk substitutes are big business, bringing in tens of billions of dollars every year worldwide, often to the detriment of children's health and development. What some have called shrewd marketing methods have helped account for the industry's success. That's why in 1981, the World Health Assembly endorsed what it called the International Code of Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes. However, 40 years later, the promise of the code continues to be inadequately realized both in Africa and beyond. Now, to find out more about the code and what might be done to help enforce it, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Manisha Tarani. She's the West Africa Director for Alive and Thrive, an international NGO that's dedicated to the health and development through maternal nutrition, breastfeeding, and other dietary practices. Dr. Tarani began their conversation by contrasting breast milk with manufactured breast milk substitutes.
Breastfeeding is the ideal food for infants. It's safe. It's clean. It contains all the nutrients that a baby needs to grow and antibodies, which help prevent the infant from many childhood illnesses. Formula, on the other hand, even though companies have tried to make it as close to breast milk as possible, is not a sterile product. And it's particularly harmful when mothers use it in a way that's not hygienic or they're not able to follow the instructions that the formula company puts out in terms of how to prepare the formula for infants.
Selling formula is very lucrative, though. I understand that historically, formula manufacturers have often resorted to highly questionable tactics to gain trust.
Yes. So, for example, in West Africa, they really interact a lot with health workers. They visit health facilities, both public and private. They try and influence health workers to promote formula. They provide lots of supplies, and they donate to health workers so that they can hand it out to mothers. And this is really dangerous because, you know, in Africa, often mothers are very young when they have their babies, and the health worker is a resource for them, and it's someone they trust.
I understand that formula is an aspirational item, too, a sort of status symbol that some mothers use to make them seem higher class.
That's right. A study that we did in Cote d'Ivoire showed that often formula is promoted also by family members based on social norms, based on the advertising done by formula industry.
Nowadays, of course, formula manufacturers also use social media.
Yes, formula industries have really leveraged social media platforms. They run mother-baby clubs. They run hotlines. They're just so clever in the way they market this to parents.
Governments would have a hard time competing with that.
So one of the things that Alive and Thrive has been working on over the last 12 years is really working with government on creating an enabling environment for breastfeeding. And by that, I mean working with them to strengthen policies, helping them put in place programs in which health workers provide counseling to mothers on breastfeeding. And we've been in very close collaboration with governments to really help the governments to understand what the situation is. In Cote d'Ivoire, for example, in 2019, we conducted the study to look at exposure to breast milk substitutes of mothers in health facilities, as well as through mass media and social media. And it gave the government of Cote d'Ivoire very concrete information that they could act on. So they found that almost two-thirds of health workers that were part of the study had had an interaction with the formula company, and only 8% of health workers really knew about the code. So in Cote d'Ivoire, the Ministry of Health is being very proactive, and now they're introducing a new module to train health workers on the code, which is very, very powerful.
Is the overmarketing of formula a problem throughout Africa, or is it just in West Africa, specifically Cote d'Ivoire?
It is a big problem all through Africa. The reason I mentioned Cote d'Ivoire is because Nestle has a big subsidiary in Cote d'Ivoire, and it's one of the faster growing economies.
Any parting Mother's Day words as we approach the 40th anniversary of the International Code of Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes?
Just to say that civil society organizations and the government, we just can't let our guard down. We have to constantly be vigilant. We have to work together to really support mothers to breastfeed. And one of the ways we need to do that is to really implement the code and make sure that it's well enforced in countries.
That was the West Africa Director for Alive and Thrive, Manisha Tarani. She was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world news and events 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. Be well be safe, and have a great day.